Football Weekly with James Richardson.
From geostationary orbit above a London gripped by frozen blizzards, it's Howdy, and welcome to iStation Football Weekly. On our near space agenda today, the biggest battle for second since Oliver Twist's department, Liverpool-Chelsea. Have Rafa's Reds turned the corner? And which SpongeBob SquarePants character does referee Mike Riley most resemble? Downstairs in the Premier League, more horror for Pompey's Adams family and Newcastle. If they're serious about staying up, surely Kinnear shouldn't have sold this Charlie Insomnia. Abroad, Serie A, here comes the calorie, and yet more on David Beckham. There's Sid in Spain and your post, all coming up in today's Football Weekly. Yes, London today in the grip of an Arctic-style blizzard. It's so cold down there that people are crowding around fridge doors trying to warm up, and that your breath makes clouds when you breathe in, which I thought was medically impossible. And struggling through said conditions, we have John Ashdown.
Hi, James.
Hi, John. What's your title? Do you have a job kind of title?
Not really, no. No, just John Ashdown is enough.
Right, okay. Mister. It kind of needs no introduction, does it?
No, exactly, yeah. All just right. all-round good fella.
All right. And Paul Doyle.
Hi, James.
A similar kind of thing
just
with you.
Mystery, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think we all know who you are. If you're new to the pod, that's who it's for, really. I think John and Paul are both valued contributors to... The Guardian online.
What you mean is we're the only ones who made it through the snow.
Yeah,
this
that
morning.
Is true. Well, Barry's here as well, but he's busy elsewhere in the canteen, I think.
Yeah. The worrying thing for everybody today is that Barry is in charge.
Yes. Yeah. So log on to guardian.co.uk to see the predictably hilarious consequences. Well done for making it in. Now, let's move on. Big game at Anfield yesterday, Liverpool-Chelsea, which... was largely enlivened by the efforts of one Mike Riley. We'll talk about that in a second or two, because downstairs, of course, this was the weekend where everyone was playing one another. Yes, all 11 of them. There were lots of draws. We've ended up with the bottom seven within 2 points of each other. And it's increasingly likely, of course, that one of the three that ends up going down is going to be a big club. Now, Roger Palmer says, will the pod actually list three teams for the drop? Every time you talk about it, you have a crack at six or seven. Live a little. And that includes you, Richardson. So, Paul Doyle, let's start off by just naming the three that you think are going down after this weekend.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, I wonder if it wouldn't be wiser to wait until around December to decide how many are going to go down. So in seasons like this, you could say five have to go down. But seeing as how they didn't do that, I'm going to go for Middlesbrough, who are on a wretched run unbeaten won in 12 and don't look like ever winning or indeed scoring again.
Right, no arguments there. But sorry, Paul, what you're saying is you'd like to see as many teams go down as possible who don't make the grade, yeah, rather than three, and then you allocate a similar number of promotions.
Yeah, well, yeah, and then, I mean, obviously there has to be teams of sufficient quality in the Championship as well to come up.
Right.
But, yeah, around the halfway mark, why not? Just have a more recycling of teams.
Like in the Tour de France, where if you don't make it to the finish line of a day's racing within a percentage of the finish time of the people who actually won that day stage, you will therefore be disqualified. So you would need to say a number of, percentage of the number of points of whoever won the title. It's an excellent idea.
That's what I'm thinking right now.
Right.
Who knows when my mind may
How
change.
How many teams do you think we'd have next year?
11.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, back to your three going down. Middlesbrough?
Yeah, Middlesbrough. You have to fear for Stoke, although they are quite formidable at home. They're wretched on the road, and I don't think home form will be enough. Home form alone will be enough to keep teams up. And then Newcastle aren't looking too hot, but Hull are plummeting fast. So I'll go for those three.
Right. Okay. John?
Well, I've written down West Brom, yes, who I think are going to struggle. Middlesbrough also. And Portsmouth, who are just a bit of a shambles at the moment. And it does sort of, that hinges on whether Tony Adams stays or goes and what have you. It could make all the difference. But at the moment, it's those three.
Right. You were sitting right next to me, and strangely, I've written down the exact same three as you. Funny that. You mentioned the question of whether Tony Adams will quite literally stay or go. He was full of fighting talk yet again. He says, I'll pick us up and get on with the next game and rally the troops. I don't run away. I'll fight, he said repeatedly. I'll be scrapping, etc., etc. I'm a fighter. We'll keep on fighting. It's a bit like the old Destiny's Child number, John, as I'm
what,
sure you...
Independent woman.
Similar. No, I was thinking of Survivor. Is he going to be a Survivor?
Well, who knows? I mean, it would be a very swift axe, wouldn't it? Because he's only been there a matter of weeks, really.
Well, he's been there for, I think, about 20 games now, hasn't he? Paul, do you think bringing in Avram Grant, who's the putative replacement, would make any difference?
I mean, I'm not sure he could do any worse. I'm not sure whether Portsmouth have the firepower to stay in the division. Mm. Did I tip them to go down just now or not? I don't think I did.
No,
so
no,
yes,
you didn't.
So yes, they'll stay afloat, right. Yeah, Peter Crouch is alone up there in this new 4-5-1 formation that he's going for. But paradoxically, that is allowing David Nugent, of all people, to thrive. So from what I've seen of Portsmouth under Adams, they're not actually playing that badly.
Are they not? I thought they were disastrous at the back results. And not scoring any
Well,
goals.
I haven't seen all of their matches, obviously.
All right, John, if you
just look at the sort of transfer moves this past month, they've obviously lost Diarra and Defoe, brought in Hayden Mullins and Theofanis Gekas over the weekend, whose goal-scoring record in the Bundesliga is excellent, but it's asking a lot for somebody to come in and you know score the goals to keep them up.
Right, potentially Giovanni may be joining them on loan today. Today the transfer market closes, so you'll forgive us if we miss out on some big late story. But in the meantime, the other question, as we say at Portsmouth, is whether Adams will be allowed to stay in the job. And I think that, you know, with the best will in the world for him, it might not be a bad thing to see him out of there. Portishead saying, Adams, I think, is the worst manager to have managed in the Premier League. Reformed alcoholics, says Portishead, make crap managers as they're far too honest to be a leader. You need to be single-minded and blind, oblivious to your own, crap and hypocrisy. It's an interesting point, that, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I heard that one of the problems with Adams is because part of the recovery from alcoholism process basically involves breaking down your personality. And so now he constantly questions himself, and there is a lack of certainty in everything he says. So even in pre-match pep talks, he'll be telling a player, you're a great player, great right foot. And then 30 seconds later, but on the other hand, right, you're a little bit weak in this area. And so mixed signals.
The only certainty is that he is a fighter and will keep on battling. There is also the question of whether it's the one job that would really drive you to the bottle. If you know, from that point of view, not the best place for him to be. However, there you go. Portsmouth in all sorts of trouble. Then they get two votes from us. Man City and Spurs had looked like they were rallying, but once again this weekend they've rejoined the throng of candidates for the drop. You were actually at the Stoke game, Paul Doyle.
Yeah, and Stoke deservedly won that quite easily. Man City were a bit of a mess. It wasn't. I talked about Peter Crouch being marooned alone up front for Portsmouth. Well, it was the same for Craig Bellamy. He just couldn't get into the play at all. He got no support whatsoever from Robinho and Ralph Phillips, who did nothing whatsoever during the game, apart from luring Rory Delap into a red card. And they were outfought in the middle. They were really hesitant at the back for something. I mean, it's a very youthful back line. They're all in their early 20s, with the exception of new £12 million Wayne Bridge, who was at fault for the goal, just as he was against Newcastle the other week. So far he's not being a particularly good signing, but he is a good player. You'd expect him to come good. And perhaps that's why they got Shay Given in. I mean, we can't blame the dithering of others on Joe Hart, but he is young and possibly doesn't have as commanding a presence as a more experienced goalkeeper would. Having said that, Newcastle's back line dithered a lot with Given behind them.
I'm really interested to see how Given does and how Newcastle do sort of post this transfer, because Newcastle's defensive problems have been their sort of a constant factor for years and years and years. The back four have all changed, but Given has been there throughout the whole lot. And you do sort of wonder if he's perhaps not as commanding as he might be. And I'm wondering if Shay Given is one of the biggest myths in football.
Wow.
Well, he does exist. Like,
I thought he'd been pretty outstanding for them this season. But
well, he has, but he makes a lot of saves.
Yes.
But a lot of the problems come with, you know, from crosses and commanding his area. I'm just interested. I'm not saying he is a pretense that he's a great keeper. I'm just generally interested to see what happens.
Oh, that is a very interesting question. I guess we're going to see, because that deal has now gone through. Is it true, Paul, that despite being a team with a man advantage, they didn't muster a single shot on goal, Man City?
They had one shot on target in the first half, which Robinho sent trickling into the keeper's arms. He totally scuffed it. Yeah, but they didn't create any chances. And in fairness, Hughes, who I'm not suggesting he should be sacked, because I think he does know what's wrong. And he said after the match that the team were very reluctant to put balls into the box because they had such small players up there, which is why he wants Roque Santa Cruz, who would definitely have made a difference, because although they didn't have any shots on target, they did have some crosses across the face of goal, that sort of thing. But Stoke's defenders, who were about 2 foot taller than anyone in the City front line, cleared them all easily.
And James Beattie proving an excellent signing for Stoke.
Yeah, 2 goals and I think in 3 games, and £5 million well spent.
Indeed, so I've got a little headline
more,
here.
More value than Kitson has given them.
Well, indeed. Sorry, I was just struggling to get my headline in there. It is a Man City crash to Beattie internet action. Yes. Right, good that Abdoulaye Faye was playing as well.
Yes, he is a good player.
Right, because there's no Stoke without Faye. Right, Bolton Spurs, meanwhile. Bolton Spurs, eh? Gary Megson, what a run he's having.
Well, it was, to be honest, of all the results this weekend, that win for Bolton is probably the most crucial of all the sort of relegation battle things. It's a fantastic result for them. Kevin Davies popping up with 2, and it's a real choker for Spurs, isn't it? The way they get, the way they got themselves back into the game, and then to lose it in late on, it must be a real psychological blow for them.
Well, it's worth pointing out that who got them back into the game was Darren Bent, who Redknapp is doing his best to flush out for some reason. He's actually got a really good scoring record for Tottenham. It's hard to understand why.
14 goals, is it this season? I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
It's 9 in the
14,
league.
14, yeah.
Impressive stuff. Is Robbie Keane's return, is that going to go through, do you think, today?
I mean, I don't know. If I was Robbie Keane, I'd hang on at Liverpool, because that's where he's always wanted to be. And who knows how long Benitez is going to be there for.
Really? You think Keane will outlast Benitez?
I don't know. But, I mean, Liverpool don't have a wealth of strikers up front. So if Torres gets injured again, he'll almost have no choice but to at least give Keane a place on the bench.
Yeah, what heady heights he might reach from there. Interesting point that one of you was making on the way in, that Harry Redknapp seems keen on assembling the Spurs team that really wasn't good enough in the first place last season. All he needs now is Wandy Ramos or Martin Yol to rejoin.
Yeah, Paul Robinson back in goals, and he'll have almost the full set.
He'll be there. Magnificent. Listen, let's talk about Rafa Benitez, because, of course, he boosted his credibility and position, etc., 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 and indeed Liverpool's chances in the title race, assuming there is one, with that 2-0 victory over Chelsea on Sunday afternoon. Manchester United, meantime, have gone 12 games without conceding. Fascinating stat I read this morning. There have been 17 managerial changes at English league clubs since United last conceded a goal. That's phenomenal.
Blimey, yeah.
I don't know if that's true or not, but it's certainly an impressive number. There you go. They got another 1-0. That's all they seem to do these days, United against Everton. And Liverpool now the official challengers. Sir Alex must be delighted with that.
It's certainly looking that way, isn't it, now? I think, it's certainly hard to see Chelsea getting back into the race. But it was a slightly, you can't argue with a 2-0 win, but it was a slightly stodgy performance from both sides yesterday. And it required a bit of brilliance from Fernando Torres at the end there with his movement to the near post to steal the points.
Right. You see him as a decisive figure as opposed to, say, Mike Riley, who big Phil Scolari, in a fairly good-natured way, was pointing to us as the man who turned the game by sending off Lampard. Should it have been a red card, do you think?
Oh, no. It was barely... Well, I don't think it was a booking. It was probably wasn't even a foul.
Right. Certainly, it was
a foul by Alonso.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, indeed. Well, the studs were up from Lampard, but on the yardstick of the way he'd been officiating, say, Gerrard's tackles and challenges, I was amazed to see him get even a card. I would have been amazed to see him even get a yellow card, Lampard.
Mm. And it was a crucial moment, simply because, I mean, Chelsea up to that point had been playing fairly safe. But from that point on, it gave the crowd something to really grab hold of. Liverpool knew that this was a bigger opportunity to go for the win. And that's the main reason, I think. Well, yeah, obviously it's a huge factor in them pinching it right at the death.
Right. Benny Yoon coming on seemed to make a big difference as well.
Yeah, he played well, didn't he? And he even got kicked after getting kicked in the back by Jose Boswinger.
Right.
But Benny Yoon has been doing well for them of late. And amid all the controversy of Rafa's decision to take off Steven Gerrard the other day against Wigan, I thought the worst substitution in that match was taking off Benny Yoon, who had played so well in that game. And it was good to see that once they went down to, once they had the numerical advantage, he did decide to go for it, because he failed to do that against Arsenal earlier in the season and could have paid the consequences.
Yeah, indeed. So just clear up the mystery vis-a-vis SpongeBob SquarePants, Paul.
Squidward.
Yeah,
indeed. Mike Riley.
And what was that Bazinga decision? Right, is that the assistant's fault? Do you think, John, for not letting Mike Riley know about it? Or
I suppose you could point the finger at assistants.
Anyone who didn't see it, what happened exactly?
Bazinga kicked Yossi Benayoun in the back. But well, Bossy. Yossi Benayoun was shielding the ball, sort of running down time, and Jose was slightly over-exuberant in his attempts to rescue the ball.
Yeah, it wasn't an accident. He just went over and shoved him out of the way with his foot on the small of his back.
Yeah, right in the sort of coccyx area.
Right next to the referee's assistant.
Is that not unsporting behaviour by Benayoun? I know it's commonplace. Everyone does it, running the ball down, running the clock down in the corner like that. But surely it's unsporting. I know he's in control of the ball, so it's not obstruction. But it is unsporting behaviour, surely.
It'd be nice. It's one of the things that it'd be quite nice to see outlawed, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a pain in the ass.
There are other sports that have rules that dictate that you're not allowed to waste time by just by sort of keeping possession and keeping the ball away from your opponents. So there's there is a precedent there that could be done. Something could be done about it, I guess.
Mm. Had Liverpool lost, the pressure would have been on Rafa to a quite extraordinary degree. I'm not sure. Does that apply to Scolari? Does he take over the hapless foreigner in charge on the bench role from Benitez, or is it seen as Chelsea's general decline that's undone them?
Well, I think it's Chelsea's general decline. I mean, Scolari, you can't see a huge positive impact he's had, but I think he has inherited a lot of problems, namely an unbalanced squad. He doesn't have much firepower. He has no width, particularly with Joe Cole out and Malouda underperforming. He's not working with the tools that a club who's spent £300 million in the transfer market should be able to provide him with. Having said that, he hasn't. You can't point to one thing he's done positively.
Even the players who used to be their standouts are no longer really doing it for them. Like Cech, for example, not looking as certain as he. John Terry, well, Drogba.
Yeah.
All right, then. Well, there you go. Outlook bleak for Chelsea. If you want more on these stories, do join John, Paul and their colleagues that have struggled in through the blizzard at guardian.co.uk/football. Meanwhile, here on Football Weekly, in a second or two, we'll be joining up with Sid Lowe to hear the latest from the Liga, and we'll have a word about Serie A as well. Part two features the welcome return of Sid Lowe in Spain. Sid, we missed you on Thursday, but welcome back.
Yeah, sorry about that. I was actually talking to someone on the Guardian desk, which is why you couldn't get through to me. I hadn't realised that you were trying to call me, I'm afraid.
Ah, that's okay. That's okay. Listen, let's have a bumper roundup of Liga-based action now. First off, Barcelona still 12 points in the lead, thanks to that man, Leo Messi. Are they becoming a bit of a one-man team?
I think that would be a bit too strong to say they're a one-man team, but there's certainly quite a lot of question marks about are they Messi-dependent. And I suppose the simple response to that is that if you've got the best player in the world, you're quite likely to be a little bit dependent on him. And certainly, Barcelona have played brilliantly all season in a collective sense, but Messi's performances have been even better. He's now on 16 goals this season. For a guy who doesn't even really play up front, is quite a phenomenal return. And I think there's a feeling that it's not so much that they're Messi-dependent as that when it gets difficult, that's when they turn to Messi, and also I should probably add that's when they tend to turn to Dani Alves as well, because they're the two people who really break people down. And last night was quite bizarre. They were away at Racing Santander, a game that I must admit I thought before the game this is one they could genuinely lose. 25 minutes to go, they're a goal down. They send on Leo Messi, and he gets two to win it for him. And certainly the first, all right, was just a pretty an average goal, but the second was a brilliant goal again. And he is playing really, really, really well, Messi, right now. And yeah, of course they're a bit dependent on him, but I think it would be too much to say that they are a one-man team.
All right, now, Arjen Robin inspired Real Madrid to a 2-0 victory, says here in my notes. That's now 6 wins out of 6 for Wandy Ramos.
Yeah, there's a one-man team for you. That's a one-man team.
Which is the one-man?
The one-man team with Arjen Robin. I mean, Wandy Ramos, what he's done is he's made them very, very defensively strong. He's made them aggressive and well-organised. But the guy really making the difference time and time again is Arjen Robin, and he created one of the goals at the weekend, scored the other, which was a brilliant goal. He looks really quick. He looks strong. He looks alert. And it's really suiting him right now. Obviously, I'm not quite sure exactly what it will mean for Arjen Robben, the arrival of Flaubert from West Ham, because, of course, that means another winger, and Robben perhaps won't be swapping wings quite so much, perhaps won't have quite much freedom. And certainly talking to him after the game, he wasn't sure quite what this will mean for him. But he is playing really, really well right now, Arjen Robben. And as I say, I mean, again, it's probably a bit harsh to say one-man team, but right now, in terms of creativity, he's the only person doing anything for Real Madrid.
My word. At least he doesn't have a history of injury problems or anything, otherwise you might worry for for Real's sake. What about the Faber transfer? Because he's still in shock, isn't he? He said he thought it was all a joke. It was a bit of a surprise, that move.
Yeah, the headline on one of the Spanish websites, I think, sums it up. It says, it has a quote from Flaubert, says, "I thought it was a joke, comma, Flaubert." And underneath it said, "Yeah, so did we." and I think that is the key. The truth is, of course, that when you sign a new player, everybody gets excited for a little while and everybody wants to believe that he's going to be really good. And you know, so there's been some attempt to talk him up. There's been talked about the fact that he's apparently very strong and very quick. I have to say, I'm not sure I've ever seen him play. If I have, I didn't notice him. But obviously the Spanish press and the Madrid press in particular have talked about what he's going to bring to the team. And they reckon he's going to be very good. And one of the things they pointed out was that he played for France and he wore Zinedine Zidane's number 10 shirt, to which the obvious response is yes, and Robbie Keane is wearing Kenny Dalglish's number 7 at Liverpool.
In fairness, he did look a really exciting prospect when he was at Bordeaux, which was why Raymond Domenech, for example, slammed him when he chose to go to West Ham. But at West Ham, he's been dismal.
Well, he had a year out, didn't he?
Yeah, that's true, he did. He got a very bad injury. And then when he returned, he was often played out of position as sort of a wing back, which he wasn't at all comfortable with. He is still strong and quick. His delivery, however, it has been awful for most of this season.
Well, the worrying thing from Real Madrid's point of view is that, in truth, and as I say, I should stress that rather than pretending I know anything about him, I don't know very much about him. That sounds fairly similar in some ways to Royston Drenthe, who's very strong, very quick, but his delivery on crosses is awful. Ooh. And he's got the Real Madrid fans up against him. I think what it does do is it shows you, to some extent, the point Real Madrid had reached. They were desperate for a right-sided midfielder. The transfer window in the winter is never really a good time for it, particularly when you don't want to throw really big money at it. When that explains why they went for Pennant, who they pretty much had agreed with Real Madrid until Juan de Ramos said, "Hang on a minute, Pennant, don't be stupid." They of course chased Valencia at Wigan, but didn't have the money to pay for him. So I think, you know, if I was a cynic, and of course I'm not, I would say that, hang on a minute, Real Madrid are buying their players now from Portsmouth and from West Ham.
Right, it's interesting you say Real Madrid not having the money. So, you know, things beginning to bite there. We could also ask you about Fulham's bid for the highly rated Spanish forward Alvaro Negredo, who's impressed for Almeria this
year. Very good player indeed, yeah.
Well, should we wait to see if that actually goes through, and we'll talk about that maybe on the Thursday?
My feeling is, and I know I'm obviously putting myself in the firing line here, and it's a foolish thing to say so close to the transfer window deadline, because you never know. I don't think that will happen.
Right, okay.
Because while Negredo wants to go to England, I think he is probably surely aware that he needs to go to a bigger club than that.
Oh. Blaugrana FC Barca, not sure who he is, but says Liverpool play Real Madrid in the Champions League soon. Do Liverpool have a realistic chance of beating Real?
Well, of course they do, but equally Real Madrid have a realistic chance of beating them. I mean, I think...
Top insight, Sid. Thank you very much.
Yeah, if you look at the way Real Madrid are playing at the moment, look at the way that Juan de Ramos is setting things up, it's very clear that Real Madrid have prepared for this Liverpool game from the second Juan de Ramos walked through the door. I wouldn't go so far as to say that Real Madrid definitely know the league title's over, but they assume it's going to be over. And everything they're doing now is working towards that game. I think they will play on the break. I think they will rely heavily on Robin. And it could be really interesting. That said, it could also be hideously dull.
Indeed. Sid, that's excellent. Thank you very much indeed. We look forward to speaking to you on Thursday.
Yeah, the one thing I should probably point out, which you haven't asked, is of course that this weekend Raúl González Blanco, the Real Madrid captain, became the club's top scorer of all time. So there we were talking about Aaron Robben being the man that does everything for them, but it was actually Raúl that scored one of the two goals this weekend. And he's now got 307 goals for the club, the same as Alfredo Di Stéfano.
Wow. Sid Lowe, a tough act to follow, and yet follow it we must with a little bit of Serie A news. Yes, indeed, John Ashdown. Cagliari, who are really tearing up the form book there in Serie A. You remember they beat Lazio 4-1 the other day in Rome, absolutely humiliated them in front of their own fans. They drew it Inter, they should have won there. This Saturday, they went to Turin, they took on Juve, who of course were challenging for first place, and they beat them 3-2. Extraordinary story, this Cagliari. Very, very bargain basement club. They don't have any money really for players. They never really have. They've been a selling club for ages now. They're generally down at the bottom of the table. It was a miracle they stayed up last season. Their president fires managers at the drop of a hat. Bizarrely, last summer he hired a man from the third division, a former player, Massimiliano Allegri, who had featured for Cagliari and various other kind of minor Serie A teams like Pescara. and had no experience in the top two divisions. They probably lost their first five games, and he didn't fire him, extraordinarily enough. And Allegri is now the toast of Serie A. His team played brilliant football, incredibly well-organised, attacking en masse, defending en masse. Just one of those teams, when you watch them, they always seem to know where everybody else is. No passes are wasted, just magnificent to watch. Got some very exciting young players there, and a Brazilian called Jeddah, who...
Jeddah. Jeddah.
I don't know if there's some sort of Saudi... probably there is. Well, we'll think about that one. elsewhere, so Juve defeated then at home, and they're now officially in crisis because that's two straight defeats. Inter, meanwhile, were held by Torino. Big surprise that at the San Siro. Adriano missing that game. We talked about him scoring the other day. He was then banned on TV evidence for punching a defender in the midweek game and is out for three matches. Inter without him were held 1-1 at the San Siro by the desperately weak Torino. So Jose Mourinho's problems continue. Milan, meanwhile, move into second place past Juventus now with a 3-0 victory in Rome over Lazio. Was David Beckham playing?
He was.
Was he ever? Was he ever? He set up two goals. The third goal that he set up, some beautiful crossing, real vintage Beckham stuff. A third goal that he set up was called back for offside. To be honest, his first, he was a little bit offside when he put the ball in for, I think, Pato on the first goal. But another brilliant night. And, of course, the story of whether he's going to stay in Italy or not continues to dominate. The word now is that it's going to cost €17 million to buy him out of his contract, which I think everyone feels is money well spent if they can do it. Posh has said yes, and apparently is now looking at Italian schools for the Bambinos. Evan G says, I'm sure everyone's wondering what a Galaxy fan's perspective is about Beckham. Very good idea, Evan. Most of us want him gone. He phoned it in the second half of last season. He clearly doesn't care about the team, unlike other major international players that have come, like Blanco or Guillermo Barros Skeletor. I think that's right. And we'd love to get some money from Milan for him. We'll all be much sadder to see Landon Donovan leave, which looks like it's also going to happen. There you go.
Donovan's on loan in Germany somewhere, yeah.
Yeah, indeed.
What's that? I noticed that La Gazzetta is calling Beckham Super Beckham this morning.
There you go. Here's the front page of today's Gazzetta. Milan, sei in corsa, sei being both six and you are, so you are in the hunt because they are now back in the Scudetto hunt. Let's have a look how many points. 6 points behind, that's what the sei is about. With Super Beckham, they beat Lazio and move past Juve. Once again, Didi David, man of the match. And they're just wild about him there.
So Corsa is the hunt?
Yes.
So yeah. Vauxhall Corsa is Vauxhall the hunt.
Indeed it is. And never was a car more appropriately monikered. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can either find us on the Football Weekly page over at guardian.co.uk/football or on Facebook. Cannon Hillbilly would like to draw the pod's attention to AFC Wimbledon's rise to the top of the Blue Square South. They beat Chelmsford City 3-1 this weekend in front of a record attendance of over 4,600 in a top-of-the-table clash. With a three-point cushion and the league's top scorer John Main on fire, promotion to the Blue Square Premier looks a real possibility.
It does, yeah, and that was a big win. The Chelmsford are the AFC's big sort of title rivals up at the top of
of course.
League. And they've been sort of nip and tuck the two clubs for a couple of years. I think I'm right in saying, I'm sure somebody will correct me on the blog when it turns out to be wrong, that AFC and Chelmsford came up together from the league below last season, AFC winning in the playoffs, and Chelmsford taking the title and have gone on to lead the way in the Blue Square South this year.
Magnificent. So they continue their rise. Chuck Schick, meanwhile, pouring cold water on the notion that football was better in the 90s. Someone had posted in with various documentary evidence that the various leagues were a lot more competitive. Chuck Schick says, very few things of note were achieved in that decade. It's bad enough that people still want to talk about Britpot as though it was a positive thing. And then he gets quite rude and starts swearing and stuff about take that and this life and stuff. What do you think, John?
I don't think take that were Britpop, though, were they?
No, that's true. It's a fair point you make.
It's a fair cop.
Right. But I think in football terms, if you just take the level of competitivity in the various leagues, it's a hard case to argue with.
In the domestic leagues, but has the Champions League not gradually become the most competitive league in the world?
Do you think it's more competitive than it was 10 years ago?
I'm trying to think. Yes, I'll say.
All right, because certainly the domestic leagues are a lot more predictable than they used to be.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And the international tournaments, I think, have been better this millennium than they were in the 90s, certainly.
Mm. All right.
The 1990 World Cup wasn't very good. 94 wasn't great. 98 wasn't great. 2002 was rubbish, and 2006 wasn't very good. So maybe you should just delete that bit.
Right, okay. 2008 was cracking, though. But, of course, international football, largely unaffected by the immense cascade of finance into the Premier League particularly, which is, I think, what most people would point to as the reason that the competition is no longer as open as it was in club terms.
Yeah, I'm sure if you looked at the league tables back then, you know, the Norwiches and the QPRs doing reasonably well, then that's just not going to happen these days.
Wasn't it you, John, who pointed out to me once that in the first 4 years of the Premier League as an entity, there was a newly promoted team finishing in the top four each of those first four seasons?
No, it wasn't me. But
it's unthinkable. You know,
it wouldn't happen these days.
No, it wouldn't.
No.
And yet it did then, so long ago.
The thing is, the whole start to the season was a fantastic story at the start of the season, but you just sort of knew. I mean, it was a fantastic one, and they played superbly. And you did sort of hope, you know, everybody was pulling for them to try, you know, to break into the top sort of, you know, seven or eight. But they're going to finish sort of 15th if they're lucky now. And it's, you know, it's that maintaining, you know, a league placing over the course of an entire season is a lot harder now than it was, say, 10 years ago.
Interesting. All right. Well, I'll tell you what's happening this midweek. The FA Cup fourth round replays. How many are there? One, two, three, four, six. Aston Villa taking on Doncaster. Blackburn taking on Sunderland. Everton taking on Liverpool again. Now, 1-1 the last two times they've met, which have both been recently. And is it going to change this time around, Paul?
Well, it could do, because it looks like Everton might actually have a striker in place. It looks like they're trying to get Joe, so
but can he
maybe
play?
That is not a striker.
Can he play? I mean, not can he play, but is he eligible?
No,
I think the rule is that you have to be registered with that club at the time of the first game
in order
to play in a replay. I think that's right.
So no... Yeah, so no, on no the
you're right. Actually, Arsene Wenger on Friday at the press conference made a good point. He said he's opposed to the January transfer window and pointed out inconsistency. He said players can be cup tied if they've played for another team. Why can't they be league tied? So if you've played in the league already for a team in the season, why are you allowed to switch?
That's interesting.
Yeah. This is the same Arsene Wenger who's trying to get Arshavin in for the last few weeks.
I believe Arshavin is now on a plane bound for Russia, that deal having failed to go through in the new wintry economic climate that is enveloping the Premier League. Well, there you go. Arsenal are at home to Cardiff. Cardiff, of course, have a little bit of a victory just by making this replay, because that was plainly their intention at the end of the first leg. Will they offer any real opposition for an Arsenal team that looks toothless?
Well, yeah, you'd expect there's a bit of a cliche, isn't it, that the smaller team's big chances in the home game, and if they draw, you fancy the Premier League team to come through and win it. Though Cardiff, though, are the Championship's form team at the moment, undefeated in 13. They haven't lost since November 22nd, which is a fair run. But yeah, you'd have to imagine Arsenal would do enough there.
Robin van Persie was being rested for this game, was he, on the weekend, or is he struggling with an injury again?
It wouldn't surprise me, because again on Friday he did talk about the worry of overplaying van Persie this season. But he also mentioned how much he wanted to have Arshavin in time for this fixture, which shows you how far Arsenal have fallen, that he's attaching such importance to the FA Cup.
And suggests that he knows less about the FA Cup rules than John Ashton, because Arshavin wouldn't be eligible to play, would he?
Well, this is what I believe is the rules.
Oh,
it's the sort of thing that I'm sure...
John Ashton, Arsene Wenger, it's a tough call, isn't it?
I'm sure the bloggers will put me if I turn out to be wrong.
All right, so now Everton-Liverpool, a view from you, John, on that?
Why not? Why can't we say that Everton will win it?
Why can't we?
Let's go for that. I think they're certainly capable of doing it, and you do wonder that if the result of the weekend might mean that Liverpool take their eye off the FA Cup ball a little.
Just on the subject of Everton and Fellaini, I can't remember which commentator was on the TV or which pundit it was, but in the first match, whichever pundit it was, noticed that Fellaini at free kicks and corners was standing right in front of the keeper. And obviously he's very tall, but he also suggested that the reason he has such an extravagant hairdo is because it further obscures the keeper's vision in such circumstances.
Yeah,
I think, you know, hair could be... increasingly used as a strategic tool on the football pitch.
Because there was a suggestion. I don't know why producer Ben is pointing at me and you, Paul. but anyway, there was a suggestion that his bonds might quite literally impede his heading ability. You're suggesting it is an advantage.
Well, no, you head with your forehead, and his hair isn't actually on his forehead. It goes upwards.
Right.
So it shouldn't impede it.
For the more follically challenged footballers out there... Paul, producer Ben wants to know, is there any rule against wearing a wig, donning a fake afro?
I'm not sure. I remember Boris Mikhailov, the Reading and Bulgaria keeper, used to regularly wear a wig. He just turned up in it one day and hoped no one would notice.
Right.
And he got away with it.
Right. If Petr Cech can wear that headgear, why can't you wear?
I assume it's something, if you're trying to gain an advantage by wearing a wig, then it'd be like a goalkeeper wearing huge clown gloves or something like that, wouldn't it? I think you're allowed, because Bob Mikhailov never used to get much of an advantage by wearing his wig being a goalkeeper.
Right. Unless he more was confidence, presumably. It's a performance enhancer.
Yeah, self-esteem was raised. Yeah. Maybe his defenders weren't sort of paying attention to him when he was, you know, struggling with his hair.
Right.
Put the wig on, and all of a sudden they were clearing out.
You do get snubbed a lot socially, you know, when you are bald. So probably, I'm going to try that.
I mean, Peter Cech's headgear is obviously for medical purposes, but I noticed earlier in the month, Karim Ziani of Marseille, when it was cold, was wearing a hat. He's a midfielder. He was playing wearing a hat.
What, a woolly hat with a bobble on.
There was no bobbin. Maybe that was the crucial factor. But
If you're allowed to wear tights and... little roll neck sweaters underneath your shirt, you should be allowed to wear a hat, yeah.
All right, excellent. Well, there you go. I think that pretty much rounds it up for today's Football Weekly. Many, many thanks to John and Paul for joining us, and producer Ben. Standing in for producer Pete, who's probably listening at home. Hello, producer Pete. And technical Ben as well, thanks to you and you listeners for being there for us. We'll be back on Thursday, so hope you have a super time until then. For now, goodbye.